Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Can you come in and take your seats, please?
Everybody has a voice.
Just need to get started for this final session of the first day at Battle of Ideas 2023. Hello to everyone, I'm Alistair Donald. I'm Associate Director at the Academy of Ideas and the co-convener of this festival. This panel is called Deifying Diversity, A Value for Our Times, and it's the partnership for this session is with the Academy, which is the summer retreat that's organised annually by Ideas Matter. So just very briefly to situate this discussion. I mean, I'm pretty sure that none of us have a problem with diversity in the sense that we probably all want to leave here tonight and meet loads of different types of people and have the possibility of eating lots of different types of food and so on and so forth, meet people with lots of different points of view. I mean, diversity in that sense is probably what everybody wants. But I think over the past few years, past period, decades maybe even, we can discuss that actually, it's fair to say that diversity has become a bit more than that. It's become something of a value that society and particularly many of the people that are in charge of society and various institutions and organisations both aspire to and would very much like to see as being a feature of their particular organisations or setups or whatever it is that they're in charge of. So we want to use this session as an opportunity to explore and ask ourselves, actually, why has diversity become such an important value in society over the past few decades? And what are the consequences of it? I mean, we had, if you think about a couple of weeks ago, Suella Braverman talk about the problems of multiculturalism. And there are definitely some people that are you saw it in Steve Barclay, for example, the health secretary earlier this week, who was criticising the amount of money that the NHS spent on diversity officers, and there's various other people that are critical of the equity, diversity and inclusion initiatives that many organisations and corporations as well are trying to introduce. So this is an opportunity to just chew over some of these things, to ask ourselves why it is that we seem so keen to make diversity a value for our times. To help us do that, I'm going to introduce the panel very briefly. You can find out much more about them all in the biographies on the website. But and I'm going to introduce them in the order they're speaking. So speaking first, a couple of my left, is Maya Frostata, who's the Executive Director of Sex Matters, the human rights organisation campaigning for clarity about sex and law, policy and language. And the long legal battle that Maya fought, that many of you know about, established the precedent that the Equality Act protects people with gender-critical beliefs and against discrimination and harassment, which seems actually quite interesting and important for this discussion. Next, we'll hear from, on my immediate left, Tomiwa Owolade, who's a writer and critic, contributing writer to The New Statesman. He's written columns and essays and book reviews for many different publications, quite often appears in The Times, which is one of the columns that I head to as a kind of must-read. And very importantly, he's written a book that's been very well received this year, This Is Not America, Why Black Lives Matter in Britain. So welcome to you, Tamira. Next, on my immediate right, we'll hear from Simon Fanshawe, OBE. He's a consultant, broadcaster, and writer. He's a diversity consultant, but also a diversity dissident. We might find out what that means. He's co-founder of Diversity by Design, which strives to make diversity a strategic driver to achieve an organization's goals. And Simon is the author of this book, The Power of Difference, which is on sale in the festival bookshop, which is just kind of out the doors there and through. And I'm sure if you want to chat to Simon about that, he might be around for a little while after.
Very reasonably priced, if I might
very
add.
Reasonable. Yes, enough of the sales. Next, on my far left, we'll hear from Mercy Moroki, who's a policy fellow to the Minister for Women and Equalities and Business and Trade Secretary. She's a foreign broadcast journalist and columnist, and her research focuses on the role of social policy in alleviating disadvantages relating to class, ethnicity and nationality. And she served in the 2020 Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities. Welcome to you. And then finally, we'll hear from Dr. Joanna Williams, who's the founder and director of the think tank Chow. She's the author and of a number of books, most recently How Woke Won, and just before that, Woman versus Feminism. She's a columnist for many different papers, including The Telegraph, Times, and Spectator, and things like that. So you see her often in print. Can we welcome them all, please? You'll be familiar with the format now. They'll do short introductions, 5 to 7 minutes. I'll kind of hold you to time because I think we want to get out as soon as possible to the audience for your points and questions. So, Maya, kick us off.
Thank you. So, I'm a single-issue campaigner. I find myself at the age of 50 going around saying, there are only two sexes, people can't change sex, and sex matters. This is not the cleverest thing I've ever said in my life. But it turns out it's really important, and I think this is the grandest room that I've ever said it in. I don't think it makes a lot of sense to talk about diversity when we're talking about sex. There are only two sexes. There is no more diversity in it. And sometimes you get organizations talking about gender diversity when really they should be talking about sex discrimination. But sex discrimination sounds like this old-fashioned idea that we don't need to talk about anymore. Let's talk about gender diversity. You know, women, they're a bit old-fashioned. But if you're gender fluid or a porogender or agender, you know, that's much more diverse than just boring old women and sex discrimination, which still happens and which still matters. And so that's why I keep going around saying that there are two sexes and sex matters. Claudia Goldin just won the Nobel Prize for Economics this week for her work looking at why men and women's careers differ, why their earnings differ. And I don't think in any of her work she said sex is a spectrum or it's difficult or it's hard to work out who's a man or a woman. By the way, I can work out who all of you are without testing your chromosomes, just looking out at you. She didn't say any of those things. Serious people don't say these things. But if you say in your workplace that there are two sexes right now, you're at risk of losing your job, which is what happened to me. And so I lost my job, and as Alistair said, I took my employer to employment tribunal. It was a belief discrimination case, and I won, and it created the precedent that not only protects people with gender-critical views, the belief that men are men and women are women, but actually any view short of Nazism. You shouldn't be discriminated at work for having or not having a belief that is serious. And that's probably the most important thing I've ever done in my life, was losing my job. And people come up, whenever I come to events like this, people come up to me and say, I said your name at work, and it was like Expelliarmus. And it stopped the Death Eaters in their tracks. And that is just brilliant. It's great to hear that. But the awful thing is that taking these cases, it's too expensive. If you have to crowdfund it, and I crowdfunded my case, it was great, and thank you everybody, anybody here who supported the case. But the reality is you crowdfund the case, you get the publicity that goes with it, you might win. I won, I got over £100,000 my employer had to pay because the court told them they had to. But I won't be employed again in my sector, which was the international development sector. And that's what people tell me. You know, they say, I'm being bullied, I'm being harassed at work, and even if I win, I won't get another job. That's the reality, and that's the reality that the diversity industry in work has created. And so what I want to say is that the Equality Act, the law that protected me and that protects people at work, is a good law. It protects people against discrimination and harassment for having any one of 9 protected characteristics. Everyone has protected characteristics. And it's not about special people. It's not about a hierarchy of oppression. It's about men and women, black people, white people, atheists, Jews, Christians, disability. You know, everyone has several protected characteristics, and they should be treated fairly at work. And I'm worried because, on one hand, some of the Conservatives are saying, get rid of the Equality Act altogether. And on the other hand, Labour are saying, you know, pile more stuff into it, make it more about equity, don't make it about simple fairness and non-discrimination. But actually, I think the law that we've got is pretty good. And the Equality and Human Rights Commission backed my case. And the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, because they backed my case and because she's spoken up about women's rights, she got bullied and harassed at work, and she was investigated over 8 months. And they've just dropped that investigation against her. She was able to use the rules to protect herself, and I think that's what we need, is to be able to use the rules and use the laws to protect ourselves at work.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike. I think that tension between gender diversity or the diversity of the type of people is kind of interesting when it comes up against viewpoint diversity, which seems to be narrowing sometimes. But we can come back to that and explore that a bit. Tamiwa.
Thank you. I think the problem with many contemporary discussions about diversity is that we don't talk about diversity with enough diversity. And by that, I'm referring specifically to race, to ethnicity, to nationality. Why should we, for example, assume that the experiences of a black Caribbean person in the UK, whose grandparents immigrated in the 50s, is exactly the same as the experiences of a black African person who immigrated to the UK yesterday? Why should we make that assumption simply predicated on race? There are other things which can define somebody's identity, but all too often when we talk about diversity, what many people in fact mean is conformity to a particular ideal, a particular ideological position, a particular moral and social status as well. And I think the obverse of that is also true of white people as well. So all too often, many people describe white people in a homogenous way without any reference to class, to region, to nationality, to all the other things which can define and determine somebody's sense of self and somebody's place in the world. I think a more constructive way of talking about diversity is to be more diverse in how we talk about it. So not only taking into account categories like race, but also taking into account categories within racial categories, taking into account the importance of not only diversity, but also pluralism as well, which should be incorporated into these discussions. In fact, I would argue that pluralism is more important than the kind of reductive notion of diversity that we often see, because pluralism speaks to the fact that people can express different points of view, even though they might share the same identity. I think this is absolutely crucial, but I think what is also crucial is that we shouldn't let these discussions about diversity distract us from the underlying fundamental humanity that underpins all of us and which should be valued above all. Thank you.
Thanks, Tamiwa. Simon.
Alistair made the point at the beginning, you know, that there's something self-evident about the idea of diversity. Here we all are, and as you said, you know, tonight, you know, we all hope that we'll eat with different people and that we'll all meet with different people and that we're all sleep with a clear conscience when we go home tonight. But what I do want to say is that, and I want to pick up what was said there, was that the reason that we bother with this idea of diversity and inclusion, and I work in this, as Alistair said, as a dissident, but I work in this because you cannot, the only thing that human beings have in common is that we're all different. I cannot understand the way you see the world. I cannot experience the way that you experience the world. But what I can do is try, but only in the certain knowledge that I'll never succeed. And it's that, it's the curiosity to do that, that makes this something that is worth doing. The problem is not with the notion of diversity, as I think we're all saying. The problem is the way in which it's become, in some ways, institutionalized. And my husband gets annoyed about this in a way, but I always use him as evidence, but carefully so. He's Nigerian. And we have a very... I mean, if you look at our relationship, I mean, he's Nigerian, and I'm British, and he's African, and I'm European, so he's black, and I'm white, and he's religious, and I'm not religious at all. And in fact, he's a Muslim, and I'm not a Muslim. And he's 26 years younger than me. And whenever I tell people that set of information, they always say the same thing, which is, how do you deal with the age gap? And what I think is interesting about that is it's because those things seem such huge headlines. They're just big headlines. In the end, don't you wake up in the morning and look at your partner and think, I have no idea who you are. And other days you wake up in the morning and think, I know exactly who you are. It's that human difference that lies at the root of why we do this. So where has it gone wrong? It's gone wrong, I think, number one, is because it's a symptom of what is going wrong with the notion of discourse and debate and discussion, which is why we're all here. If you look at the last 3 weeks, something extraordinary has happened, where it seems impossible, as my friend Ruth, a 78-year-old Jewish woman, said to me the other day, to hold the view that Netanyahu is the worst thing that ever happened to Israel, that Hamas is disgracefully vicious and unpleasant, that there should be a Palestinian state and Israel has an absolute right to exist. Those are, to me, completely consistent opinions, and yet the political context in which they exist means that you have to choose some kind of binary. So the first thing that's a problem, I think, is that, and it's odd that the people who say they're non-binary are the most politically binary people in the world. But so diversity has been dragged into this binary idea of the way in which we see things. So disagreement becomes hostility. So that's one thing we have to, and what we have to work out about that is not sit and scream and shout about it and stamp our feet, but we have to work out how we do something about changing the way in which we have those discussions, and this is obviously part of it. The second thing, I think, is that it's based on a notion, when you think of it in organisations, it's based on a notion of victimisation or victim mentality rather than agency. So I often say to people, you know, who are gay, I say, are lesbians and gays equal in Britain? And the answer is, apart from religious institutions, yes. Anybody here is old enough to remember Bobber Job Week? You know, big yellow tick, job done. You know, we started Stonewall, we did the job, and then they looked around for something else to do. But the point is that, you know, I mean, I was one of the six founders. I'm a very disappointed man. But the point is that not giving people agency deprives one, as you were saying to me, of the understanding that we have to see people as individuals as well as understand what might be their group discrimination or their group disadvantage. And that group disadvantage is not similar. You will be treated as a black man on the streets, irrespective of class and whatever and whatever. But when it comes to thinking about who you are as Tomiwa, then it really matters who you are and what you're. So one of the things I do a lot in work is say to people, what are those deficits, those diversity deficits really mean? And how are you going to tackle them? Accuracy is important. Second point to that, you have to then start thinking about not just the deficits and seeing it all as a victim, as a default mechanism, but you have to start seeing it as something that produces extra value as human beings. And in organizations, the only thing we've got in common is what we said we were going to do, whether it's making pizzas or widgets or whatever it is. When you get to work, did you know those people before? No, you're all strangers. You've only got one thing in common, widgets. No, I sound like the man in The Graduate, plastics. But the only thing you've got is that. And so what you do is you work out how to collaborate with other people through their difference. And that difference comes in all sorts of ways through all sorts of routes, partly identity, partly personality, partly all sorts of other things, family roots and so on and so forth. So I would suggest that we need to think about it both in terms of the deficits which need to be tackled, because that's about disadvantage and blockages to talent, but also in terms of the dividends. And the last point I would make is that there is this, the problem of subjectivity and the idea that only black people, whatever that means as a group, you know, have you ever said to anybody, oh, I'm BAME? You know, hello, I'm a BAME person. No. You know, people say to me, oh, are you LGBT? And I say, well, it can't be all of them. You know. But my point is that organisations behave as if you can. So you've got the LGBT, you've got the women's group, the BAME group, and they talk to this group of people as if they've got one voice and as if they are the source of the only bit of information or policy formation. So who have we consulted on, you know, what we're going to do with women's facilities? Well, actually, that's the trouble. They never talk to the women. They go to the LGBT group and say, do you identify, you know, as an outside loo? And then we'll turn them all into gender neutral. But my point is a serious one. Staff groups are dangerous when they only look inside and become grumble hubs, and they don't look outside towards the purpose of an organisation. So diversity, my final point is that diversity must be about purpose. And the last thing I would say, sorry, that was my penultimate.
Sneaky.
We need to rescue diversity, and we need to rescue it from the left that has perverted it and distorted it through an identity political lens, and from the right, who distorts it through wholesale rejection. We need to find a way which does not replicate their binary when we talk about diversity.
Okay. Lots to chew on. Mercy, your thoughts.
Thank you. The first thing I want to say about what's gone wrong with diversity is that the definition is incredibly unclear. What it's used as is a very crude measure, and a crude measure of visible characteristics, so whether we're talking about race, ethnicity, trans identity. And what's never taken into account is that part of doing diversity properly is acknowledging that actually people don't naturally tend to get along very well. And if you're going to have different groups, different nationalities, different ethnicities, and different religions, you have to have some sort of management strategy almost. You have to account for the fact that different people living in a society or in a workplace, there will be conflicts, there will be tensions, and it's never taken into account that part of governing or managing an organisation and dealing with diversity is having to do that. And because we use diversity in such a simplistic way, where we say sort of there's X percentage of, you know, black people in this organisation or in society, I think it's becoming very counterproductive because we're almost losing the case for diversity by mismanaging diversity, by pretending it's all sort of motherhood and apple pie and everybody will get along if we just sort of throw rights at everybody. And there's no acknowledgement that some of those rights sometimes will come into conflict with each other, like what we're seeing with women's rights and trans rights, for instance. And the same can be said of religious rights as well. For me, true diversity is something that is more sophisticated, I would say, and it's about diversity of experience, diversity of aptitudes, of skills, and something that takes into account actually that you have to manage the conflict, you have to put into place, whether it's integration policies to make sure that, you know, people who are living together or working together are not coming into conflict all of the time. And it's another thing I really dislike about this idea of crude measures of diversity is that it assumes that just because somebody is a certain characteristic or has a certain characteristic, that they will believe or bring something that's independent of what somebody else can bring. And it's not obvious to me that just because you put a black person in a particular workplace or put more black or Asian people, that that does meaningfully increase diversity. And the example I always use, and it's not to dig at the man at all, but the example I talk about is Kwasi Kwarteng, who of course was a very short-lived chancellor. And Kwasi Kwarteng, yes, he's a black man, obviously, he comes from Ghanaian parents, but he was born in London, went to Eton, went to Cambridge, went to Harvard, worked for JP Morgan. Now, if you're a bank and you're trying to diversify the experiences and the thought in your organisation, it's not obvious to me that hiring Kwasi Kwarteng just because he's a black man will make you any more meaningfully diverse than perhaps hiring a white working class person who went to a state school and who's clearly, you know, very bright and can survive in that environment. So there's a simplistic, crude way that we do diversity that I think we should stop with. The other problem I have is that essentialism that is inherent in the concept of diversity, because there's an assumption that just because you have a sort of representation of particular characteristics, so descriptive representation, that it will lead to the substantive representation of a particular group's interests. And what I mean by that is that just because, so there's an essentialism, if I'm referring to myself a lot, but as a black woman, as others have said on the panel, I'm a, you know, Kenyan-born woman. I've grown up in Northamptonshire pretty much all my life. It's not clear to me why I share any affinity, I should share any affinity or have any special connection to somebody who's a third generation Caribbean person who's lived in London all their life. We won't necessarily have any shared interests because we're different people and with very different backgrounds. And I do feel that diversity tends to reduce people very much to characteristics that are ultimately arbitrary. But actually, I should say where I feel strongest that you can make that, you can sort of say because you have a characteristic, you're going to bring a particular thing. Where I feel strongest, perhaps, is with sex, because there are very clear biological differences, and the argument is stronger there that women will bring something different to men in an organisation or in a society. So that's perhaps where that argument would be strongest. I'll finish by saying that I think we shouldn't sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to diversity. It has very commendable aims. Of course, it's all great that, you know, we should aim for a society where there are different people and different opinions and perspectives and that we all get along. And so I think we should aim for that. But we do need to get back to the why. What is the point of doing diversity? And the why should be because we truly want to reflect different perspectives, and we truly want to reflect different experiences and aptitude and skills. And the way we're doing it now, where it's just you sort of focusing on very simplistic characteristics, is absolutely not that.
Very good. Somewhere behind us. Thanks. I think some very useful challenges in that contribution, and things that we should definitely come back to. Joanna.
Thank you. I think diversity is a very funny word, an odd word. On the one hand, it's not a value at all. It's just a fact. It's just a description, as has already been alluded to. But it's a fact and a description that has somehow been transformed into a value. And I think both the way it's used as a description and kind of held up as a value are both incredibly negative and have... for me, they have very problematic consequences in the way this word's being used. I think a lot of the points I want to make around diversity as a fact, diversity as a description, have already been made, so I'm going to rattle through this a little bit and then get to the points I want to make about diversity as a value. So in terms of diversity as a description and how this has been how this has become kind of something which is held up as important to us, for me, you know, the problem is that it focuses on the least interesting thing about us. It focuses on our genitalia, which we had no say in. I agree with Maya on these points. You know, I'm female because of my chromosomes and my anatomy, you know, not because of my thought processes. It focuses on the colour of our skin rather than the content of our character. And what happens then is, again, as Mercy was saying, you know, that this identity then becomes reified, it becomes essentialized, it becomes the way that we are seen and judged as we go out into the world. Then, as Tomiwa said, you know, these physical differences mask intellectual conformity. You know, you could have a boardroom full of people who represent, you know, the entire rainbow flag of sexualities and the whatever Dulux color chart of racial identities, but everyone thinks exactly the same things. points have already been made also that it overlooks class and the importance of social class identity. All too often the focus is on biology, on race, on sex. It is not on social class. And by ignoring or overlooking or having a blind spot for social class, it allows the existing inequalities that we've got to continue. So in short, you can say a diverse elite is still an elite. But what happens then is that this fact of diversity, of our biological, our essential differences, has morphed into a value we're all supposed to buy into. And what I mean by diversity as a value, I think you have to unpick that a little bit. And what's the opposite of diversity? The opposite of diversity, presumably, is sameness, is homogeneity. And so diversity as a value represents a move away from that homogeneity. I first came across the phrase pale, male, and stale about 10 years ago when I was working in a university, and a senior academic came out of a lecture we'd both been attending and rolled her eyes, and her comment on it was, well, that was all a bit pale, male, and stale, wasn't it? And clearly what she meant by that was absolutely nothing, no reflection on the content of what was being said, but it was purely a remark about who was saying it. And she saw the fact that what was being said by white men, essentially old white men, meant that it was inherently problematic no matter what they said. So it's an attack. Diversity means not pale, male, and stale. Essentially, it often means not white, not male, in particular, not white working class men. I think this is why it becomes a value for our times, because white working class men are often seen as a problem today. It means not traditional, not old, not that this is the stale part of it. It becomes an attack on rootedness, essentially, on family, community, nation. So what does it mean then to embody the value of diversity? It means to not be pale, male, and stale. It means to float free of the ties of the past, the ties that would bind you to a nation. It means to be an identity, first and foremost, rather than to be an individual or to be a member of a community or a family or a nation. You're an identity. You're a rootless identity, a plastic, malleable identity. Which brings me on then very, very quickly to end with the why. Why have we got this transformation into a value? What is it that's attractive nowadays about people being these rootless identities, these plastic, malleable people? Number of ideas to float out. I mean, first and foremost, it weakens democracy. It circumvents democracy. We're not members of a nation. We're not members of a community. We're these free-floating identities. It meets the needs of the global economy as well, which is not for working-class white men who are going to be doing manual labour, but for these free-floating identity types of people. It changes the relationship fundamentally between state and citizen, between employer and employee. And I really take off from this the points that Mercy was making about diversity needing to be managed. As soon as we're set up as these competing identity interest groups, then the path is cleared, the need arises for somebody to step in and manage us. And as the general public, we're not citizens, but we are kind of people being identities being managed by others. And we become interchangeable identities. We're not these important people, individuals in our own right, fixed into our communities or our nation or our families for the purposes of capital, if you like. We are interchangeable.
Thank you very much. So just to assure you, there'll be plenty of time to come back on each other's views on the panel, but I want to go straight out to the floor first and just get a batch of questions in that we can mull over and work some of the responses into. So I'm going to start down here. Where have we got the microphone? Could you just give it to the guy in the front? And then where's the other one? Could it go there? Yes.
Hello, my name is Gerard Hosier. I just want to ask a question about victims and heroes. Victims and heroes, I've worked for 30 years in news, and news creates victims and heroes. And the reason they do that is because they get to own the story of the so-called victim or hero. And they're able to monetize it, own the story, own the copyright in many cases of the story, and they own the person. And one of the problems with using the word victim and hero, or in particular victim in terms of diversity, is it takes the power away from the individual and it gives it to the, say, academic body who is desperate to make you a victim, or the institution who can monetize your victimhood, or, you know, the political body that can exploit for political ends your victimhood manufactured. And I've noticed in the UK now, particularly with race, and I'm from a Windrush child, is that many friends were completely British. And now, with this recent revisionist history, we have all become victims, and we feel actually like outsiders. So, in fact, what has happened is the organizations have made us others, victims. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can I just see the hands still? Could you take the microphone there, and someone's got the one over here. Yes.
Hi, I just wanted to ask the panel, do you think it's possible that there's too much diversity, or that there could be too much diversity? The reason why I raise this is because there was a study by Robert Putnam, and he looked at social trust when you have diversity initially, and that actually you could have areas where there are lower social trust, and that correlates strongly with diversity, although over time the social trust increases and it becomes fine. So I just wanted to ask the panel, is there too much diversity? Also, with Simon's point on managing diversity and not being binary, while, you know, I'm sympathetic to that view, don't you think that actually sometimes there is a conflict on these issues, and sometimes you do actually have to take a stance, even though, you know, it might align you with people you might not necessarily agree with or might not like on one hand? Because I think that sometimes there is a tendency to say, well, let's not be binary on these issues, when actually sometimes that can also be used by people to say, well, let's not talk about it, let's downplay it, let's not pretend that these conflicts and tensions aren't happening. So I just wanted to put that to the panel.
Okay, someone's got the microphone in here. Yes.
Mercy, I felt, was absolutely spot on about the importance of integration, and diversity, as you say, is very complex. And that's probably why this so-called intersectionality is infinite, if you think about it, because everything crosses over all our various multiple identities. I'm very interested that the gentleman over there mentioned Robert Putnam, who was referenced recently, actually, at a New Culture Forum conference by Rafe Hayden-Mankiw. And Robert Putnam, he was a liberal, and he worked for Bill Clinton, and he was very uncomfortable with his findings. He was a sociologist, because his findings were that the greater diversity in a community, the more social distrust, the less social capital. So people would volunteer less, and there would be more distrust. So how do we get around this? Because many of us have multiple identities. And I think there is no easy answer, but as all of us seek an identity, and we need to be receptive to this, we can have multiple identities, but I think my argument would be we need to have at least one identity that's overarching, that is what we have in common, so that we can bring us together, and that might be nationality, that might be something else, but I think that's certainly something that we need to consider. What do we have in common?
Okay, thanks. That microphone's going to the back, and someone's got one up here.
Oh, hello. Fundamental question. How can we have a creative, purposeful diversity that leads to enrichment of life and for all of us? And the answer, patiently, is we can't. It's a myth. It doesn't exist. Simon, you've talked about promoting diversity, but what you actually advocated was the opposite, that organizations should focus on whatever their purpose is, whatever, making objects, pursuing some profitable pursuit, and the identities of the people involved are irrelevant. The place for cultural and sexual and political identities to exist is in self-organizing civil society. It's not in professional organizations. And really, we've got to face up to that. Because the reality, as you said there at the end, is this isn't about promoting the dignity or rights of people. It's about fragmenting society. And the objective, the target, isn't inequality or discrimination. It's democracy.
Okay, thanks. And the person at the back, yes.
Yeah, and then following on from that, I wondered if it's the kind of pseudo-representation, so way of saying that institution represents people by having, you know, one of this, one of that, and one of the other. So it's almost like a way of bypassing meaningful public representation and it being kind of symbolic representation. The other thing, I wonder if Joanna could develop the point she made about disconnected identities. I think that's really important. There is a kind of deracination of the forms of culture that are involved in diversity. So, I mean, just if you look at gay culture, for example, like 20 years ago, gay culture was back streets and bars, and Pride was actually a community there. But now Pride is like the NHS parading. You know, it's something, and trans identity seems to be something that largely exists in institutions and in forms of public performance, rather than actually having a kind of a community, a root in society. And so I think that disconnection is really important in the way that the cultures exist as symbols in relation to the market and the state, largely, and not actually in terms of people's social relationships or kind of connections with others. So that kind of, you could get that disconnection point a bit more.
Simon, can I come back to you first? Because there was a few things that were directed at you, I think, there. But perhaps the common theme might be that the type of diversity that you were describing is perhaps just not possible with, alongside the sort of politicised value diversity that Joanna was talking about. It's, you know, kind of, how do you see that?
Well, I would make the distinction again, in case people didn't hear it at the beginning, between what I think is diversity is a fundamental fact, as you would say, of our existence. All I'm saying is what we do is we recognise that, and I'm suggesting we recognise it in two different ways. We recognise it because we look at data, and data tell us that there are disadvantages for certain groups of people in certain situations, not, you know, to be taken as headlines, but actually to be investigated with seriousness and penetration to understand exactly what's happening there. That's the first thing. The second thing is what happens when we combine differences. The other day, I was faced with 150 people from Balfour Beatty, the big construction company. It was their UK construction company. 140 men. I think most of them white, I can't remember. I said to them, very diverse, I said, so I'll just collectively address you as Kevin. And they, you know, because I was kind of trying to make them laugh about it, because I needed to beckon them into and away from the fact that they had been told that they had no view on diversity because they were white men, that they had no role in this, that they had no part in this, which is absolute nonsense. What we needed to do with that group of people is to get them to be joyous about the fact that, notwithstanding that they were apparently this homogenous group of people, what they had within that was incredible diversity of thought, background, etc., etc., etc. And it is in the combination of that and the recognition of that difference that they can reach really good discussions about risk. And I said to them, the purpose of this is not to give you a set of rules, it's not to lay down a set of prohibitions, it's to work out how you can work really well together so the buildings don't fall down. So where I would say about you, you know, the problem is in the practice of it, it's not in the idea of it. So it can be a value to understand and value, see difference, value it and combine it. I don't think that does de-link people. The project of identity politics de-links people from society. And I would say, sir, that the project of the right, I don't know if you're on the right or not, but the project of the right to trash diversity is precisely about actually trying to reject and go back to an idea of women and of black people and of immigrants and so on and so forth. And you see it constantly used as a tool against immigration. So I don't buy either of those political projects. And I say to both of you, get out of my work and let me concentrate on actually the value of human difference.
Right. Joanna.
Thank you.
So I really wanted to come back on the question that was asked somewhere over there. I can't pick out who exactly, about can we have too much diversity? And I think my answer would be absolutely not. If we're talking about diversity as a fact, you know, bring it on, why not? I think it's a great thing, as we've already pointed out. You know, it makes the world more interesting, more exciting to have different people, different ideas, different foods, music, everything, you know. I think where it becomes a problem is when we are discussing diversity as a value, and I think that's the really crucial difference. And I think we can have too much diversity as a value, because I think celebrating diversity as a fact in a community would, for me, be focusing not just on what's different between us, but more fundamentally also what we have in common, and a kind of celebration of our common humanity. And I think that's the really important point. But when we come to diversity as a value, it becomes very divisive. It, as Simon's saying, it's the identity politics focus on what's different about us, what's dividing us one from another. It's about essentializing, as I was saying earlier, the most boring aspects of our life, and it destroys this idea of kind of integrated communities. It, I think the word was used over there, kind of fragments us rather than binds us together, and I think that's a really, really big problem. On the question at the back about I can't put it as articulately as you, I'm afraid, and I may have completely misunderstood you, but I think when we are kind of treated as the products of diversity as a value, and we become these essentialized identities, it seems to me, essentially transformed into a product almost ourselves. We become a commodity, or our identity becomes transformed into this essentialized kind of commodity, which again is sorry, I've lost the plot on that one. I'm not explaining it very well, but it gives you a clue as to where I'm heading.
We can come back to it, though. Tamiwa, anything that you wanted to pick up on? But one, I thought one question I have to you, given your kind of quite nuanced understanding of diversity and the fact that we need to speak of it in even more diverse terms, is it the case that diversity is simply about promoting diversity, or is it actually attacking homogeneity? Because when I think about when I go home, and this is probably the only mention ever that Dalgetty Bay will get in Battle of Ideas, but it's kind of a, you know, it's mostly between sort of 60 and 80 years old, the people that live there, almost all white. And yet it's a lively, quite diverse place. So, but it seems often that diversity is specifically attacking the homogeneity of those sorts of towns.
But I would dispute the sort of assumption that those towns are necessarily homogenous in the first place. And that's what I mean by the fact that when we talk about diversity, it's often used as a fig leaf to talk about conformity, various kinds of conformity. As everyone on this panel has said, diversity is a fact. And I think one of the issues is that we have this very reductive notion of what constitutes diversity. So I was born in a country, Nigeria, where over 99% of the population is black. So diversity in Nigeria is not predicated on race, of course. It's predicated on things like region, religion, class differences, various other types of differences rather than just simply race. And incidentally as well, I think that's one of the reasons why when many Nigerian immigrants move to a Western country, for example, that's the first time in their lives when they start to consider themselves as black. Yeah. So Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the Nigerian novelist, said that the first time she thought of herself as a black person was when she went to America for the very first time. And I think having a notion of diversity, which actually encompasses the fact that diversity means something different to different places, is absolutely crucial. And on the point about the victims and the heroes, I think when we talk about diversity, it's often used to sort of categorize people as either villains or oppressors and an oppressed group. So we see that, for instance, in the Israel-Palestine conflict, when many people are arguing that we should be understanding, we should give more context, we should be sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. I think we should be sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, but that's often used as a way to justify the greatest slaughter of Jewish people since the Second World War. And I think this sort of binary of simply seeing people as either villains or victims or heroes is again, undermines what I think should be a better way of thinking about diversity.
Okay. Anything that you want to pick up on, Maya and Mercy? And if we keep your contributions quite short, yeah, I'll go back out and I'll give you longer next time.
I wanted to come back to the gentleman who talked about victims and heroes and also villains, I think. I mean, I've been all three. it's a very human thing. You know, we love fairy stories. It's very easy to connect to people and want to decide who's a hero or who's a villain. And this, I think, has been the corruption of EDI in the workplace. So a couple of weeks ago, I sat in and watched Jo Phoenix's tribunal. She's the professor who's suing the Open University, and her lawyer was cross-examining the dean of EDI at the Open University and putting to her that Jo Phoenix had been discriminated against because her colleagues wrote this open letter saying that the university should discriminate against her. And he was saying to the dean of EDI, do you understand this is discrimination? And she said, can you tell me what you mean by discrimination? So the dean of EDI, so he gave her the definition of discrimination from the legislation, and she said, I have a problem with this concept of discrimination. And you know, this is the person who's training other people to understand what diversity and inclusion is. So this just complete corruption of the idea that discrimination is about treating everyone fairly. And just clearly, her idea was it's about dividing people into the good guys and the bad guys. Mm. And in her mind, Jo Phoenix was one of the bad guys, as there are people who think I'm one of the bad guys, and therefore could not be protected against discrimination. So I think, you know, it's a very human idea. It's a very easy to get idea, but it's fundamentally corrupting.
Okay. Mercy, anything?
Yeah, so the question of can you have too much diversity, we have to, I think, accept that the idea that minority groups have some special affinity with each other because they're minority groups is a complete fallacy. And so the assumption that minority groups will get along because, you know, in America you might have Hispanics and black, you know, African Americans, and of course they'll get along because they're both minority, it's a complete fallacy. There's plenty of data to show why minority groups have so much tensions in societies, in Western societies in particular. And so it's not surprising to me that there are tensions and there is mistrust between different minority groups and between minority groups and majority groups. And that's why I think managing diversity is so important. And one final point is, I came to this country when I was 5 years old, 6 years old, and it was not, so this was in 2001, so you can figure out my age, but it was not until 2020 when the Black Lives Matter movement really kicked off that I ever thought about myself in racial terms at all. I had never, not once in 20 years of living in this country, thought of myself as a black woman or that there was something different about me because I was a black woman. And so I think you can have too much diversity in that you can have too much of an emphasis and too much of a focus on diversity, and that racializes people, and that is divisive, I think.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. So I want to come out for some more questions. I'm going to give Joanna 5 seconds
Thank you.
To retrace her steps.
I captured my thought where I was going with the whole commodity product thing, which I was expressing very, very badly. What I was trying to say was that when we become an identity, this reified identity, and we're identities that are being managed by other people, then we become an object, essentially, rather than a subject. And by an object, I mean we become passive, we become done to, rather than being a subject who's a doer and a kind of agent of change.
Okay. That's what I was trying to say. So, I want to get two more rounds of questions in, which means that everybody's got to be reasonably concise from now on. So who's got the microphone? Does someone over here has got a microphone? Yes, so reasonably concise.
Yes, yes, sure. No, I just want to pick up the question of, could there be too much diversity? And I do think in a certain sense, yes, absolutely, this could be quite dangerous to society. And the diversity I mean is not the superficialities of skin color, or religion, although there might be indicators of something deeper and substantive in a sense of degrees of development. I mean, you have to recognize the fact, and that also speaks to, let's say, multiculturalism, a certain ideology of multiculturalism I reject, which seems to be saying that all different cultures, no matter what development status, would be of equal value. We have to recognize that people coming from all over the world to particular countries with particular prosperity potentials and standards of living, and that these, that this prosperity and standard of living is based on certain cultural achievements, ways of interacting, doing business, attitudes, life attitudes, dynamics, a certain footlooseness and cosmopolitan attitude, levels of education. And if you bring in populations from much less developed countries and they're brought into these societies on too large a scale, and then we're telling them we don't put the pressure of integration on, but we're allowing these parallel societies to exist and fester and subsidize through welfare. I think the welfare provisions and welfare subsidizing of a lot of underdevelopment as pockets within all advanced societies is a huge problem. And then you look at some of these, and finish that thought, some of these groups are not progressing equally in particular levels of society. And you think that's to do with discrimination? No, it is to do with degrees of underdevelopment which are subsidized by welfare. And that's quite dangerous to these, in many ways, generates these tensions, unresolvable tensions.
Yeah, but sometimes pressure of integration has an authoritarian undertone, which is often it's the absence of anything culturally wise or of significant value to integrate into that's quite often the problem. Yes.
Hang on.
Thank you. In education now, when you mark exam scripts, you don't know the gender, the ethnicity, or the religion, or the school, or anything, because it all appears on software on a screen. So it should remove a lot of the biases, if there were any before. But then the government produces, by ethnicity and gender, the different point score averages on their website every year. So, and there are differences between ethnicity and gender. So you end up with this data, but I suppose my question is, what would you do with it? What kind of imperative is that to act?
Okay, and there's someone with a microphone there, yes.
So I think society needs to have a completely different attitude towards sex as compared to race. And I also think the diversity discourse gets it completely wrong. So on the issue of sex, I think as a society we need to recognise that men and women are fundamentally different. That's the essential building block of a successful society. That doesn't mean that one group is superior or better than the other. It simply means recognising difference and being comfortable with it. Now, the trans discourse, by the way, is an offshoot of the diversity discourse, the feminist discourse, which has simply tried to overcome or pretend that there aren't those differences between men and women. So they just take the logic of feminism, certainly second wave feminism, and say, well, look, if there's no real difference between men and women, then why can't I wake up tomorrow morning and announce that my gender is different? So that's the diversity discourse, and it gets its approach to sex completely wrong. Now, the interesting thing is when it comes to race, it has a completely different approach because it celebrates difference of race. In fact, it makes it the most important thing about people of different races. Now, of course, we all recognise that people do have different backgrounds, but the point about a successful society is that it needs a process of assimilation so that regardless of that different background, you all share the same culture within a national framework. It's Martin Luther King's approach of wanting to judge people by the content of their character, not the colour of their skin. And I think, again, the diversity discourse gets that completely wrong.
Okay, thanks. So, someone somewhere over here. Yes, you go.
One fan, anyway.
Go to Rakib.
Hi. What I want to ask, really, is listening to some of the panel, just saying that the problem with diversity is there isn't enough of it. That strikes me as leads me to the question of why is diversity a good in itself? I don't understand it. I understand why equality and equality of opportunity is a good in itself. I understand that having people from different backgrounds, but the idea of protected characteristics, which is what diversity is based on at the moment, doesn't seem to lead to anything other than the world which Joanna was talking to, of atomized people wandering around on their own, everyone having their own particular label stuck to them, and is in no way productive or cohesive for society as a whole.
All right, I'm going to take three more. That microphone goes to the woman in the blue T-shirt there, and someone over here has got one.
Yeah, thanks. I don't think it's possible to overstate the extent to which diversity is a value, and to follow on with Joanna's distinction between diversity as a value and diversity as just the way we live, is an elite, corporate, divisive and anti-intellectual value, and that's the way it confronts people. Fairly recently, with some colleagues, invited the well-known gender-critical individual, Alice Sullivan, to speak, and it was very interesting. The talk was called A Feminist View of Academic Freedom, and I did the thing that you'd expect me to do, which is I invited our EDI team to come to the event, and the response I got to that was, thanks for the invite, but what has a talk on A Feminist View of Academic Freedom got to do with EDI? To which I responded, feminism has had something to do with the last 200 years of struggles for women's equality, which is something to do with equality. And then the response to that was, fair enough, Jim, but what's EDI got to do with academic freedom?
Oh, God.
And that's an even bigger faux pas, as far as I'm concerned. Fortunately, I came to this conference and I've learned from Aqua Reindorf that academic freedom itself is legally protected as a belief under the Equality Act. But more broadly, you know, the staggering anti-intellectualism and stupidity involved in openly thinking that EDI has nothing to do with the diversity of ideas. And there you have it. That's the institutional view.
Okay, thanks. That microphone goes to the woman behind, in a couple of rows behind. Someone over, who's got it? Yes.
Oh, it's your husband.
Yes, go on.
I just wanted to ask, if you had to give Britain a score out of 10, how well do you think it's doing in terms of managing its racial and ethnic diversity? And if there was one policy that you'd introduce to better, for Britain to better manage its diversity, what would it be?
Okay, thanks. That's nice and short. That's the way they should be. Yes.
When I fill in a consumer survey, I'm asked about my household income and often about the level of education I've achieved. When I'm filling in an equality monitoring form, my degree of wealth and privilege doesn't seem to be taken into account. So I want to ask the panel, why in diversity monitoring is wealth and privilege deemed not to be important? Why do we want to disregard that as a factor when we know that actually poverty is a huge factor in what children can achieve and what they can achieve later as adults?
Okay, I'm going to take a couple more. The next time we come out, then there's a cluster of hands here that is going to go to. There's someone back here. Yes.
Thanks. I think on the race topic, I'm mixed race, and I feel that the race narrative is actually quite harmful to some or many mixed race people, and particularly to mixed race families. So that's one point about it. And the second is I sometimes find myself being kind of condescended to by kind of, you know, to use a shorthand, like white liberal types who tell me how kind of oppressed I am, or like maybe my passport won't be processed properly because of my name and things like that. And my impression is that it gives them something to do.
Okay.
And it also maintains any hierarchy that still exists, because if I am this lower sort of status person in British society, then it's like white saviorism, but it's also, it's not just saviorism, it's also, it maintains them as above, like all the while I am thinking, I'm not denying there has been racism in my life, but all the while I'm thinking, yeah, I am oppressed, or all the while I am oppressed, whether it's thinking or being, they are automatically above because, you know, there's some hierarchy, I can't explain it that well, where there's something going on, and I kind of feel that there's an investment in making black and brown people in the UK from some sections of society to feel like we're oppressed because it maintains any existing racial hierarchy or racial advantage that might exist.
Okay, we can come back and get some comments on that. So I'm going to come back to the panel now. If we can just whiz along and, you know, give me a minute or something, pick one thing, don't pick everything, just pick something to respond to, and then we can come out and have a final decent round of questions, and I can still give you a decent amount of time to make some final remarks. So should we just start at this end this time? So Mercy. Yeah.
Yes, I'll take the one about educational outcomes and then I'll do class. So I think educational outcomes, yes, in theory, when you're doing a sort of a blind marking of an application, yes, that is the fairest way to do it, although there are people who would argue they're a reflection of sort of ingrained inequalities in the first place. So that's people who advocate for equity. They say, actually, standardized exams are discriminatory, but that's another issue. What I wanted to say is that we are in a place now in the UK where ethnic minorities are objectively doing far better than white people educationally. By the time they're finishing primary school, ethnic minorities in general better at reading, writing, and maths, better GCSEs, better progress eight scores, higher, about half of Asian and black students are now applying and getting into university. The number for white British students is about 33%, so a third. And I don't know if some of you saw the article in the Telegraph a couple of days ago that said for the first time ever, applicants to Oxford are now majority ethnic minorities, so white applicants to Oxbridge, rather, are now minority white. So this, I still can't believe that people still try to maintain that there is some sort of institutional racism in our education system, because if we're just going by outcomes alone, I mean, I'm not denying there are racist incidents that might happen within the education system, but if we are to take the outcomes as the proof of what is happening in our education system, then it's completely sort of anti-scientific, anti-intellectual to pretend that somehow ethnic minority children in education are not doing as well as white children.
Okay, just one point just now, just so we can get back out again. Maya.
I completely agree with, I can't remember who said it over there, that sex and race are completely different things. And we're kind of misled because they're, you know, two different boxes on the monitoring form into thinking they're the same kind of thing. You know, sex is a couple of billion years old. It's ingrained in every cell of our body. It's the pattern of all complex life. Race is really, it's only skin deep. They're just quite different kinds of things. So when we look at the data and think about why, you know, why children are achieving in school and what's happening with their careers and their life chances, sex and race and class are all quite different things. And, you know, one result of that is that we think that single-sex services, single-sex spaces are completely legitimate things to have in lots of situations, particularly where people are undressing, vulnerable, need privacy, whereas racial segregation is not. It's not protected by the Equality Act. It's never allowed. Of course, people can meet together in, you know, in different groups and different cultures and so on, but sex and race are just completely different things and we need to think about them in different ways.
I think the lady at the back raised a very important point about the absence of class in discussions of diversity.
And many people, for example, ask why is there so little diversity, for example, in the publishing industry, or in academia, I think the way I would respond is by saying that the stereotype about the African or Asian parents that wants their child to study either law or medicine or engineering is true. It is a true stereotype. And one of the reasons why there are so few black people in the publishing industry, for example, is because publishing industry pays so badly. So you can only survive in an industry like that if you have intergenerational wealth. Yeah. And many immigrant communities and, of course, working class communities don't have that wealth. And if you come from one of those communities and you are particularly ambitious and want to get on in life, why would you go into an industry that pays so badly?
Yes. Very true. Simon.
I think the problem, again, I go back to this thing, that's the way in which identity politics has distorted the real fundamentals here. So we've talked a lot about trust, and Putnam was brought up, and so on and so forth. And it feels to me like the way in which this notion of diversity is talked about, and so on and so forth, is it's talked about in a way that somehow is about protecting us from the real value of human interaction. It's constantly an attempt to avoid the friction, which is the creative result of that interaction, to avoid the conflicts, which is where we get the good kind of discussions. And it's how we build trust between each other. We build trust between each other in communities because we understand more about each other and we start to create a common good. And what's interesting about Putnam's work is he constantly talks about this idea of bridging capital. So what happens originally is that, yes, when communities, people come into communities, he calls it hunkering down. And they do. We hunker down to our own. But what happens is that gradually we start to bridge capital. And he uses the example of Jews marrying out, for instance. That has created an integration within America, which creates a common view and a common idea. So I go back constantly to the need to build universal values and the recognition that we do that by the recognition of each other's differences. And those differences come from sometimes culture, sometimes race, sometimes class, sometimes sex. They come from a multiplicity of things. But it's important to understand that difference, because if you don't understand the difference, then we can't create the common goal in the end. You asked what we would do in order, how well we're doing on ethnic diversity in Britain. I have no data on which to kind of answer that question, but then you said, what would be one thing that we would absolutely do? And I would say, abolish religious schools.
Okay. Joanna.
Thank you. Yeah, I also wanted to come back on Rakib's point about managing diversity. You know, I wouldn't want to give a score for it, and I wouldn't want to even suggest a better way we could do it, because I think that it's the very project of managing diversity, which is the absolute worst thing about diversity as a value, this idea that we all need to somehow be managed, that we all need to focus on what's different between us, and then we need to be managed. I think it absolutely relates to the woman who was speaking over there, who described kind of white liberals basically telling her she was oppressed as well. It gives them something to do, and that's very much how I would see this project of managing diversity, is it gives some people something to do, and they're often very, very well paid for it. And
no, we're not.
some of them are, to be
not
fair.
Us freelancers out there begging, we're on our knees,
like the man over there said, you know, can often go about it in a very foolish way. I mean, I think for me the point is that managing diversity is fundamentally the opposite of integration, and by integration I don't mean making everyone the same, but it does mean finding something that we do all have in common, and it was national identity which used to play that role. And the more confident you are in your identity as a nation, the more you can allow for differences, diversity as a fact.
Okay, final round of questions. So there's still a lot of people want to speak, so really do try and keep them quite short and
pithy. I will be concise. There are about 5 million people in this country who think they're unemployable. And they think this because people like us go to great lengths to tell them so. If you are blind, you are not wanted. If you are deaf or in a wheelchair, you are not wanted. If you're neurodiverse, or learning disability, or mental health issues, you are not wanted. So for all these people, the fashion for diversity is the greatest thing that's ever happened.
Okay, you pass that microphone back to the guy behind you. There's someone right at the back there with a microphone.
Hi, just following on from the nice lady who spoke, because I'm bisexual, and I too get the feeling that half of me is treated like a sort of disability, and half of me is absolutely fine, and if I marry a woman, then I'll pass and I'll be accepted, and I can be in the elite class, and if I don't, well, then you'll just be one of those people, but don't worry, we tolerate you. And that is something that we don't talk about with this very divisive ideology. But this very divisive ideology is quite intellectually thin. It's often defended quite rudely. And actually, I think we've seen some of that this afternoon. Is it possible that it's being defended rudely, not because it's a good ideology, but because it's a way of earning a living?
Okay, thanks. And there's someone down here.
Yes, thank you. I think we heard about the if you're pale, male and stale, you'll just be derided before you even get the chance to speak. I think it's also true that it's very easy to be categorised as a race traitor. So Tony Sewell, that excellent report in 2020, looked at the really granular detail, like Tamira describes, black African children doing far better than average, black Caribbean doing worse. And he was, as I say, demonised by so many on the left who just want to talk about heroes and villains and victims. As we said before, my point would be this. Liberalism is sometimes described as an anti-culture. It tries to strip away individual norms. If you're conservative in Sudan, you're very different to a conservative in Buckinghamshire. But if you're a liberal, you should be the liberal everywhere. Two problems to that, though. One is that when you arrive in Britain, you don't suddenly become embodied by the spirit of John Stuart Mill. You still bring everything with you. And more importantly, there's nothing to integrate into. And I think this is why the question was deifying diversity. What are the values that still link Britain, that we can all come under the same umbrella? What would those be today that aren't just the individualist autonomy, etc.?
Okay, thank you. Can you take that one over there? Yes.
Hi. I'd like to pick up on a point made by Simon at the beginning about staff networks, which I think is a hugely consequential issue, which is really underemphasized even in kind of free speech spaces like this. They are all over the civil service. They are all over our institutions. Mm. They're all over the Anglosphere and Europe. I'm a now ex-civil servant who spoke out in my department in summer 2020 against the sort of critical race theory push as part of the kind of Black Lives Matter moment. And I kid you not, every single day of my life since then, I've been in the same fight. And it's the staff networks that are at the root of this. You know, they can organize complaint writing campaigns. Exactly. There's a kind of strange, incestuous relationship between management and staff networks. Management, in my case, actually reached out to the staff networks to ask them to complain about me in order to get the complaints they wanted. They have this problem that's already been mentioned about enforcing homogeneity within so-called diverse groups. I had a Caribbean lady who was passionately supportive of me, spent five hours venting her fury down the phone in a conversation with me about how I had been treated. When I asked her to come to a disciplinary meeting with me, she said, sorry, I'm too worried about my career. There was a final point I wanted to make, but I guess I'll leave it at that. People are worried Klaus Schwab's running the world. I think it's the networks. We've got to do something about them.
Okay, thanks. That microphone's going way back. There's a guy here.
Yeah, thank you. I think what I'm missing from the conversation so far is that there is a lack of, and I don't want to sound like Jordan Peterson, but a meta-narrative, be it patriotism or liberal values, which has been replaced by this religion of diversity. Now, I know Joanna said diversity is just a fact, but then you also proceeded to say the more diversity, the better, different foods, different ideas. But if diversity is a fact, gravity is a fact, nobody would need to promote it. It would just be, and it would organically appear. Yeah, and yeah. Unless it all works under the umbrella of a meta-narrative like liberal values, I think we will see what we are seeing today, namely a lot of different conflicts based on arbitrary characteristics. Thank you.
Okay, there's a woman in the green shirt right on the right-hand side at the back who's had her hand up for ages. There's someone down here with a microphone, and then we'll go to you.
Hi. So I wanted to speak just a little bit to Joanna's earlier point about the distinction between diversity as a fact versus diversity as kind of like a central axiomatic value that we should be striving towards. And I'm doing this to kind of sort of steel man the opposition, I suppose, because I think if you were going to talk to like an EDI type or like a critical race theorist, they might say that we need diversity as a central axiomatic value, because what else would we replace in its stead? And the value that we might replace in its stead might speak to only a certain majority group. What that group might be, they'll probably focus on race, but it could be any of the groups. But I suppose if we're not focusing on diversity as a central axiomatic value, what do we replace in its stead, and how can it speak to all individuals?
Okay, thanks. Someone in there, and then you.
So,
No.
Me? Or you?
Whatever way, someone just speak.
Yes. So I just wanted to challenge Simon and maybe Mercy a little bit, because I think when it comes, as Joanna says, when it comes to the politics of diversity, I mean, everyday difference and diversity is a fact, and it's mundane, but I don't think that's what defines the purpose in life, just accidental demographics. But when it comes to the politics of diversity, I think we should most categorically reject it, because I think it's a very complacent outlook on the world. It doesn't, the difference in itself does not provide meaning, and I think the politics of diversity is simply an employer's charter to, as an excuse, to manage in a rather elitist way the viewing the workforce as objects and basically a potential problem that needs to be managed. And we're not. We shouldn't have to be, you know, at the end of the month, we should get paid for the product we produce or the service that we provide. We should not have employers intruding into our lives in a very demeaning fashion.
Okay. There's one more person somewhere behind you in the blue shirt. This woman here is going to speak, and I'm afraid that's going to have to be it, because I want to give 90 seconds.
I wanted to say,
sorry. Sorry. I didn't...
An angel from heaven.
Yes, go on.
Someone asked a question earlier about what policies do we need. I'd say, which policies can we get rid of? A way that I would probably repose what the last speaker said is, your family, they might not have to like you, but they have to love you. The nice thing about work is you don't have to like anybody.
Yeah.
You go to work just to do your job and get paid, or for the company, make the widgets they want you to make. The problem I have with diversity and all of my experiences going into various different companies is that through the intranet, through all the various different mandatory trainings, all the rest of it, what happens is you don't just have the choice not to like people anymore. What happens is the day-to-day way that we're presented to each other is through a whole range of policies. So we can't just get on with each other spontaneously. There is almost a colonization, if you like, of all sorts of various different aspects of life within the workplace, which I think becomes problematic. So it's not just about the race, it's not just about women's rights, it's more about the incidental, mundane aspects where we're presented to each other in particular ways.
Okay, thank you. And the very last one, someone up there, then I'll come back to the panel and I'll give them about 90 seconds each, I think, is about as much as I can give.
What we've not heard spoken about today is one place where there has been a notable increase in diversity in the recent years, which, not perhaps the most expected place, but in the Tory cabinet, when three of the top positions and the Prime Minister have all been held by people from minority groups in the last year or so. And possibly the next leader might be someone on the panel works for. How does this change the whole debate when, say, Labour's never... And by the way, I'm not saying this is a Tory supporter, I'm not. But when Labour's not even had a female leader yet.
Okay, so there'll be plenty of time tomorrow to pick up some of the themes that we've started to develop today and to answer some of these questions, which inevitably, in 90 seconds... we're not going to be able to answer tonight. So if you haven't got your ticket for tomorrow, get it, come back. But how should we do this? Should we just go along the line? Should we start with you, Mercy, and just go
Right the way through? Just very quickly. So I think I would say class is the single most important thing in both determining somebody's life on average. You can you know, estimate how well their life will do and what their outcomes will be by class more than any other characteristic. And I think, as the lady mentioned up there, there are characteristics we are very much neglecting because of this obsession with LGBT identity and sex and race. And there are other protected characteristics, as Maya pointed out. And I'm not suggesting we move to a world where we're completely obsessed with characteristics in general, but we need to remember actually there are things more important than what somebody looks like and, you know, what their genitalia is. And we need to find that shared thing we can all get behind, as many of you have mentioned.
Thank you very much. Maya.
I agree about widgets, purpose of organisations. That's why we go to work, is to achieve some mission, and that's how we create wealth and we create value, and that's what it should be about. So there should be less bringing your whole self to work, leave your whole self at home, get on with the job.
Absolutely.
I agree, get rid of staff networks, and I think, you know, as I said, the most important thing I ever did was lose my job, and there are implications of my case that will still continue to play out. I think one of them is that if, as an employer, you have staff networks and you celebrate Trans Day of Visibility and you celebrate all of these different days, you also have to celebrate Gender Critical Day of Visibility, or you can just say no. We won't do any of it. And I don't think you should be celebrating Gender Critical Day of Visibility, but I think the answer is you treat everyone fairly by saying no, celebrate your own days at home with your own community, bring your work, your professional self to work, and leave the rest of yourself at home.
Tom.
Yeah, as to the question, the final question about the ethnic diversity of the current Tory cabinet. It's interesting because many of these Tory politicians are often referred to as race traitors as well. But I would respond by saying the striking thing about many of them isn't the fact that they are Asian, but the fact that they come from Asian families that migrated from East Africa. Mm. And if you come from that particular background, if you come from a background where you can't, your family can't rely on the state to support you, your family can only rely on individual aspiration and local family networks, it would make sense why you become a conservative. It would make sense why you would espouse conservative values. And again, it goes back to the key point, which is that diversity is often used as a fig leaf for conformity. And diversity in terms of politics, in terms of political opinions, is absolutely crucial in any kind of pluralist society.
Just in case I ever get accused of not being diverse enough in my promotion of books, to me, its book is available at the bookstall, and so is Joanna's as well. So you can buy any of their books at the bookstall. Simon.
I think disability is really interesting. There's this phrase, reasonable adjustments, which is the legislation that says you've got to provide reasonable adjustments to somebody with a disability. I turn that round and I talk about conditions for success, and one of the things that I find really interesting, it's the opposite of victim. It's giving people agency. So if you use, for instance, disability as a lens through which to look at things, or mental health as a lens through which to look at things, one way is to say, oh, poor you, you know, you're disabled and we've got to do this and we've got to do that. Oh, you've had a breakdown, you come back to work, you know, we'll give you a nice soft lighting and so on. So there's a better way to look at it. And the better way to look at it is to say, what your disability teaches me about is the reminder that everybody's got different conditions for success. And so in order for people to contribute at their best, we need to understand what different people's different conditions for success are. So I've always found disability an incredibly helpful lens. When women go away and have children and come back to work, don't ask them what they've forgotten. Ask them what they've learned, what experience they're bringing back to work. Don't send them to Harvard to learn about pressure of work, time management, stress, and pain. ask them what they learned through bringing up children. So all these things are ways of giving people agency. So what I would say is, yes, staff groups are absolutely toxic. And one of the really big problems, not always, but one of the really big problems, and I work with tons of them to try and stop them being toxic. So if anybody wants to help me by bringing me into their organization to help do that, I'll try. But the real problem is the chief execs, the HR directors, and that lot behave like anxious parents outside the disco who can't say no to their teenage children. It is quite extraordinary. They will not say no to these stroppy teenagers. And so what we've got to do, anybody here who knows chief execs, ask them why they're going along with this absolute nonsense which says that they can lay down rules and prohibitions like that. So, you know, I'm a diversity distant because I think that this is not about diversity, it's about the combination of difference in pursuit of universal values. That's it. It's about purpose.
Okay. Jo, you have the task of bringing the day to a close.
Oh, thank you. I thought the comment about race traitor was very interesting because it really shows to me how the focus on diversity racializes people rather than moving beyond race as a category type. It essentializes not just our skin color, but it associates particular ways of thinking with a skin color, which I think is an incredibly backward and regressive move. I think for me, the fundamental takeaway I'd like to leave people with is I think we need to move beyond diversity as a value. In fact, I think we need to absolutely reject it because it forces us to focus on what divides us. It forces us to focus on what's different about each other. And I actually think the world would be a better place if we focused more on what we had in common and what we have that unites us rather than what we have that divides us. That's it.